volume was too high, remember?
This is Channel One, Side Two, December the 5th, 1969. Channel One, Side Two, December the 5th, 1969. We're beginning this tape after having taken in the tape recorder for repairs. The tape recorder came back with, we hope, some repairs, but not completely repaired. However, the needed repair on it now is the microphone channel 2, which doesn't record. However, we've discovered that the microphone will record on channel 2 from the channel 1 jack. However it does this, I don't know. But it does. The only thing is that you can't use the two simultaneously. Anyhow, we are starting this tape, leaving a fairly large gap between what we were doing and what we were talking about at the end of the first side and what is going on now. And we hope to fill in some of that gap from a breakfast conversation tomorrow morning. This is Sunday morning, December the 7th. We didn't fill in that gap when we expected to. Everyone was too busy to do anything about it. Besides, with our tape recorder back, we wanted to play the tapes that you sent us that we had not heard. So we've been spending all of our free time playing those tapes. But this morning, Sunday, December the 7th, we're sitting around the breakfast table, and it looks like we're going to have quite a bit of free time to work with the tapes, because outside we have a sleet storm going on with rain and sleet and ice, and the whole countryside is covered with pine trees that are bowed down to the ground almost, some of their limbs breaking off because of the accumulations of ice on them. We are not about to stir out this morning. We have a fire in the fireplace, and we are sitting around the dining room table. We think that it's a good time to catch up on some of our activities. And we thought that Donald might talk a little bit about what's been going on in his shop. As you will recall, when we ended the last side, Donald was trying to get a rotoverter converter to convert his power line from single phase to three phase electricity so he could run his motors that he had bought from Claude Sheets. So Don might want to talk a little bit about what's happened since then.
What was that Wayne said about the rotoverter when he left the other day after he had done some wiring on it, Jack?
He said that if anybody wanted three-phase power up here from now on, that they'd have to put it in themselves, because he wasn't going to fool with another rotoverter the rest of his life.
Do you know what kind of trouble he was having with it, Ben?
Yeah, he was having a lot of trouble, partly because he wasn't familiar with the apparatus, and partly because the wiring on it had to go through a length of flexible cable and several right-angle fittings. And there must have been 8 or 10 wires going through that 1-inch or 1 1/4-inch cable.
How many?
And, you know, they're heavy wires, heavy gauge number 6, I believe he was putting in, which is about as thick as, the copper in it is a little thicker than an ordinary pencil lead, and it's pretty stiff. And each of those has to be pulled through the cable and pulled through the fitting individually, because they don't come already in the cable. You know, you buy the you buy the armored flexible tubing, and then you pull the cable through it, pull the wire through it. And he was fighting with it. He fought with that all day. Was it Friday that he was struggling with that?
While we were trying to get
the
lathe off of the truck.
But he finally got that all straightened out Friday afternoon, I guess. So Saturday he was wiring inside, yesterday that is. He was wiring inside and he ran some of the three-phase conduit and ran lines to, ran a line anyway, that we played around with hooking up to various machines to see what it would do.
Did you get your lathe hooked up?
We tried it on the lathe and the joiner.
Oh, what happens with a joiner? I heard somebody say that they were running a plank through a joiner and it hit an indestructible knot. What happens then? Does somebody get hurt, or is it a dangerous operation?
It is dangerous. A joiner is probably the most dangerous thing in the shop because you're pushing a board over a drum that has about three or four blades in it, and the drum revolves under the board like a saw blade, but it goes the whole width of the board, so it's got a considerable amount of friction on the board. And if one of those blades hits a nail or a hard knot or something, it can tend to knock the board back out from under or out across the joiner, and the board comes out with considerable force and can do some damage if it hits anything. And also, if your hand happens to be over the blades when it knocks out, you're going to go down into the blades if the guard doesn't stop you. And so you have to be careful when you're using it never to get your hands on the board over the hole where the blade is. Dad watched me using it yesterday. And if you noticed, when I was pushing a board up, as soon as I got near I would swap hands and reach ahead of it. And go on across that way rather than pass my hands over the opening where the blades are turning.
In other words, if you get too familiar with this gadget, it's like what she said about familiarity with the horse, the stallion. You remember? It breeds contempt.
Yeah, but you don't dare get contemptuous of this thing or familiar, because then a lot of people lose fingers and things that way. Fred was telling a story the other day about how he used to own one until it got somebody's finger, and then he sold it because he got tired. He didn't want it around.
How did you first happen to come in contact with Fred?
With Fred?
Yeah.
Gee, that's been so long ago I hardly remember. I guess it was, the first time I met Fred was, remember when I was up here that summer after I got back from overseas, and I brought my Renault up here, and it was having trouble. The distributor on it was bad. It had a leaky distributor, and it wasn't firing correctly, and it pulled to a stop out here on the road in front of the house. And I couldn't get it started yet. And we went up, and Fred was the only, it was a Sunday.
That's right, it was.
We had just gone out for a Sunday drive and took Grandma and Barbara up to the trading post, and I think that was as far as we got, and it started acting so bad that we came back.
That's right.
And nobody else was open. And Fred was, and he came up, and started going over it, and he got it to go enough to get it down at the shop. And I forgot where they got a new distributor cap for it.
You had to go down to Wilkes-Barre.
He fixed the old one enough so that it would, he cleaned it out.
Yeah.
Because it had a crack in it that was conducting the current across the points.
Oh.
And he cleaned that out and dried it out so that it would fire enough so I could get it down the hill.
We left it there, and we got the other car and went down to Wilkes-Barre, got a distributor cap, and came back.
That's right. You're right.
That's right.
So we had to go get the part.
Now, well, you seem to think that Fred was quite a character then. He was.
Oh, he came out and looked at the thing, and I made some inane remark like, well, it was running fine a little while ago. And he said, yes, and so was the Titanic, but she went down.
That's typical.
And then I think the next time Donald had much to do with Fred was when he was making his cannon, and he needed some parts or to do some blacksmithing or something.
Well, that was
the cannon you brought back from France.
Yeah, and I guess that was the next summer.
Yeah, that was two summers ago.
Yeah, because I needed some welding done on some parts that I was making. Well, I had seen Fred though about getting an anvil, you know, that piece of railroad iron that I used for an anvil. I got that from Fred, and also he guided me to the wheels that summer that I used on that particular carriage. He knows where all the wheels are in Ashe County, I guess.
That's the reason he wanted you to have your shop there. He can sell your wheels.
Anyway, he got interested in what I was doing then, and you know, I took the cheek irons and other things that I was welding on, needed to be welded around, he did the welding on them. I don't think he ever saw the complete gun that summer, though.
No.
In fact, I'm sure he didn't.
No, he just heard it on the 4th of July.
He heard it on the 4th of July, right. But he got kind of interested in what I was doing, and it made a strong impression on him, I guess. But
you know, this work you were doing this summer, before you even thought of that, not early this summer, but after you came back from South Bend, and you got the wheels to mount this barrel you brought back. He and Betty were terrifically impressed with the patience that you had in working those old wheels, reworking them, getting them into shape, and that impressed them, I think, terrifically, because you were willing to put the time into them to.
Well, I think Fred is pretty well impressed with anybody who will work at anything. He's a worker himself, from the old days. He used to build roads. He and Betty, I think, are both from Indiana originally.
Oh, really? I thought
Betty
they were local.
Anyway. I think they both come from up Indiana way. I know Betty does. She's got a brother-in-law up there and so forth. But they came here. Couldn't have been too long ago, because now that you mention it, I think Fred is a local.
Fred has his brothers and his father and all of his people live around.
Fred is local, but Betty's not. Betty is from Indiana. But Fred has worked all over. He used to work up in Indiana building roads. And I guess that's where he met Fred.
Oh, he's the one that told me that that tale of that when he was working on the roads and the rain and the mud. And they had the equipment got bogged down, and they'd have to dig down. What did he tell me? How many? 35, 40 feet deep before they could find something solid enough to put anything on to haul the trucks out of it.
Gosh,
sounds like one of Fred's stories, anyway.
Well, he's full of tales about road building. Betty says he's the only man that alive that can lay a road by eye. She says that he does better by eye than these surveyors do with their instruments.
Well, that's experience.
It's a matter of experience. I don't know. I've never seen him do it, you know, but I'll take her word for it that he can. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he did. But the sort of fellow that that grew up doing everything just by experience. Tells tales about running machinery for these road grading operations. He was complaining the other day about how everybody takes so much time to do anything. And if you've seen him work, you know that when he gets his steam up, he really rolls.
Yeah, tell us about how you put your stovepipe in. You were very carefully using a star drill and hitting the concrete block.
I was going to cut a neat circle through the block, you know, and just slip that pipe through there. It'd be you know, a perfect fit all the way around, I thought, you know. And Fred got tired of that, and he said, "Wait a minute." And he reached over and got a sledgehammer and went, wham, through the wall, and knocked a hole. But you can march a Marine band through, I guess. And his comment on his favorite expression for operations of this sort is, "Don't ever be afraid of messing up as long as you can cover up." You know, he'll go through a wall like he's taking a bulldozer through it, and then he'll go back and patch with cement, you know, around the hole. It looks all right now.
Well, Betty says that he does things the practical way. And you are a perfectionist, and Fred can teach you a lot because he can show you the shortcut.
Yeah. The sledgehammer way.
Yeah.
Yeah. He said he got so tired of watching some fella run a motor grader on one of these highway projects he was working on. He said the guy was just chugging along in second gear, you know, and just barely creeping up and down this stretch of road. Finally, Fred says, "I thought you told me how you knew how to run a motor grader." He says, "Get out. Let me show you what to do with it." And he jumped up in the saddle and high-geared that thing, went tearing off up the road about 30 miles an hour, just throwing dirt left and right. Turned around with a flying skid at the far end, came ripping back, and said, "Now there, that's how you run that thing." The guy sat there with his teeth hanging out for a while. But that's his style, and I know it must pain him awfully to be stove up with his heart so much now that he can't work that way all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Wayne, what was it Wayne said, Jack?
Wayne says that the doctor's been telling Fred to slow down for years, and Fred won't pay any attention to him. And Wayne says the reason he won't pay any attention to him is that he's a show-off. Fred's got to be showing off all the time. He says he was that way when he was a little boy. Wayne's a couple of years older than Fred.
He is.
I didn't know that.
Fred looks so much older.
Right. But Wayne says he's a couple of years older than Fred, and he's known him ever since they were kids in school together. And he says Fred's always been that way. He wants to do things with the big dash and the bravissimo flourish, and he just isn't going to slow down. He's going to keep on doing that way until probably finally his heart's going to kick off on him.
That's his style, all right. And he you can see it in his attitude. You know, when he does something, you know, gets it finished. Now there, that's the way it's done, you know.
he throws it out, you know, with this big gesture, flourish.
There it is.
And it's a good thing that he wasn't around when we were getting that lathe off the truck.
Gosh.
He would have had a tizzy, I know.
Well, that's a good story in itself, that lathe. I mean, from the time you put it on the truck until you got it up here and then got it off.
Yeah. Because the guy down in Winston-Salem, where I went to get it, he didn't have much in the way of lifting equipment. He had to go out and borrow a forklift to put it on the truck with. And when he put it on, I knew it was heavy, but I didn't know how heavy it was. Because I could see looking at it that it was, it's about 10 or 11 feet, 12 feet long. and with this big overhead, top-heavy overhead drive and belt, flat belt pulleys hanging way up in the air over your head, and a massive cast iron frame. I knew it was heavy, but he got the forklift out, and of course a forklift makes heavy work look easy because it's back weighted and it can pick up several times its own weight. Holding it close to itself with the forks, that way the work never gets a leverage on it. So he went in and picked it up with the forklift and set it on the truck. But when he set it on the truck, I knew it was heavy, because that old truck suspension went down about 3 feet, I think. It just, he put it down, and I said, "All right, it's on the bed." And he said, "All right, now I'll let it down." And he started letting it down, and he kept letting it down. And then the bed kept sinking under. And I thought, "Wait a minute, we're going to hit the ground any minute now." Uh-huh. And he finally put it on, got loose of it. And it was still off center on the truck because of the way I've got the winch on the truck mounted against the back of the bed. It sticks out, and I couldn't get it over in front of there. I was afraid if I put it directly behind the winch, it might roll forward if I stopped and smash the winch. Mm-hmm. So I had to set it to one side.
Heavy as it was, could it roll?
It slid. It walked around a little bit. After I tied it down, I took the winch cable and wrapped around it, and wrapped around the truck bed, and went over the top of it and tied a bunch of knots and tied ropes to it wherever I could, and used up some of that man's wire, wiring it down, and it was roped and wired and winched and everything else, and still it managed to walk around a little bit. I had to stop and readjust the load two or three times on the way home.
It took you 5 hours to come up here from Winston-Salem.
Well, yeah, but I stopped in Wilkesboro and took it apart on the way, because I took the spindle out of it to leave with Brock and Tilbert, the machine shop in Wilkesboro, to have the chuck fitted to it. And when I stopped there, I thought that I would just be able to drop the chuck off and say, "Here, make a faceplate for it." And as it turned out, they needed the spindle, too, to be sure that it was true, which makes sense, and I should have thought of it. But what it meant was that I had to stop and take the bearings out and lift the spindle out and leave that with them and then put it all back together again. And that took me a couple of hours there.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I got up the hill in about 3 hours actual traveling time.
Yeah.
But getting it up here was the easy part.
Get it off.
Yeah, now. When you get it up here, then you've got to take it off the truck. And that's what took us 3 days.
Fred Krebs brought his, I mean Bill Krebs brought his front loader on his tractor around to see if he had unloaded, a lot of this heavy stuff.
Yeah, he loaded up
before. With his front loader. He brought his tractor around and backed it up and shoved the scoop at the front of the tractor up under the bed of the lathe and pulled his lever, and the whole thing went
So he tried it again and went
didn't even budge.
So Bill Krebs looked there and eyed it for a minute, and he shook his head sort of slowly and says, "Not going to do it." And we'd gotten him out. That was a cold, windy day.
It was cold that day.
He'd gotten out, came out talking about having to get into his long handle underwear and everything else.
He was bundled up.
He was really bundled. And so
had his World War II pilot's hat or something over his ears.
But anyway, then Don decided that he would have to try to get a forklift from West Jefferson to come out and, one of the big lumber forklifts, maybe from Midway Lumber Company.
Krebs said Midway had one that they took out occasionally and loaded stuff for people.
So Don called the Midway people, and the Midway man says, well, says we've got a big forklift, all right, but we don't have a truck to carry it on. And we can't send a man out to drive it up there because he'd freeze to death before he ever got there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true, too, because
that was
a windy day. Oh,
yeah. Not only was it down to 10 or 15, but it was the wind was blowing.
And those old forklifts won't drive much faster than 15, 20 miles an hour at the most. So then Don decided maybe he could get a forklift from the Rotans, and that's what he was going to do when he went down to Wilkesboro, you know, try to catch the Rotans.
I talked to guys at Brock and Tilbert, though, and they thought they were the ones that backed up your suggestion that maybe a wrecker could lift it off. They said that they thought that it could lift it. They weren't sure about whether it would be high enough or not, and I wasn't either. That was why I was, hesitant. But the guy brought his wrecker out from, they convinced me to change my mind about the Rotans, and rather than have them drag their big forklift all the way up the hill from their logging operation down there, I called the Gulf Station up here and got their big wrecker out. But if I was right, it wasn't high enough, really, because we had one Dickens of a time. That would have put Fred in the hospital if nothing else, just watching us.
Well, he probably had some better suggestions for rigging it than we did.
Well, you would think that the wrecker people would know how to rig it.
They're not used to lifting lays off of trucks.
Well,
they work
picking
with
something
vehicles
up off the ground, you see,
yeah.
And they're not high. Most wreckers don't have an extendable telescoping beam on the back. This one didn't, even though it was a huge one. And when he backed up to the lathe, the top of his beam, where the pulleys are for the cables, just barely cleared the ways on the lathe. And so he couldn't really lift very high.
He could only lift about 6 inches.
He only got about 6 inches of lift, and the truck bed came up with it.
Oh, yeah.
So he never did really get it off the truck bed. We had to drag the truck bed out from under it.
Oh, God.
That was what was weird, because, you see, he could take most of the weight off. He got the front end off the truck bed, which was the heavy end. And what we had to do was attach the winch cable from the truck, from my truck, to the front leg of the lathe, and while he was pulling up, the lathe was top heavy. You know, I told you it had that overhead drive motor, and the lathe wanted to just flop over backwards and fall. And we could see that developing as he started to lift it. So I ran the cable from my winch to the leg of the lathe down below where he was tied on, and pulled the opposite direction to straighten it up. And that seemed to work all right, but then I couldn't stand there and work the lathe and drive the truck, so I got Dad to hold the lathe, to hold the winch handle, and I went down and put the truck in back gear and started to move it out from under the lathe.
Yeah.
And while I was moving forward, Dad had to let the winch out to allow the lathe to maintain its equilibrium there. And while he was letting it out, of course, as soon as it cleared the end of the truck bed, the other guy was over at the wrecker letting it down. And if that wasn't Harry.
And you want to know why I didn't go over there? You talk about polluting the air with cigarettes.
Well, you know, one time when he was lifting and raising that heavy end of the lathe, we had pulled out the strip of wood that the lathe was sitting on. Not the truck bed, but between the truck bed and the feet of the lathe.
You had to put wood under the lathe
to keep
it going right through the bed.
And then he let the lathe back down on the truck bed, and that foot of the lathe bent one of those boards on the truck bed down like that, and if he had continued letting it down, it would have gone right on through that truck bed.
It was massive.
It was massive.
You figured it at about what weight?
Easily 3,000 pounds and maybe 3,500.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly, but it was so heavy that it wouldn't stay. It would go right through the truck bed. I knew that when he started to let it down with the forklift when I was loading it. And I got some heavy hard wood put under the feet across the planks to support it.
Yeah.
And
well, now I don't understand. After you got it off, I mean, you pulled the truck out from under it, and
then it was just dangling.
Yeah, and he let it down on some planks or something.
We had two big 4x4 oak beams that we had prepared.
This big.
Yeah.
We prepared them the day before by drilling holes in the 4x4s where the lathe feet would rest and setting lag screws in them. And of course, we took the screws out and let the lathes down on these 4x4s, and then put the screws back in so that they were
bolted.
And oh. Bolted to these big beams.
Yeah,
and then
sort of a sled
like a sled.
Oh,
uh-huh. And then to move it inside, we had to get it. He had let it down on the gravel rather than on the apron, because once he picked it up, he couldn't move anywhere with it. So we were down on the gravel, and it wouldn't slide on the gravel. We had planned to put it down on rollers on the cement apron, but we didn't get that. So to move it. The next day, well, we did that the same afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We got it up on the shed.
It was a busy afternoon. But to move it, I backed my truck around and ran my winch cable through a block attached to the roof of the shed, to the beam across the roof.
It didn't bring the roof down?
Well, it didn't have any weight on it.
And ran it from the block back to the lathe
on the sled
and hooked it there, and then I sat up on the truck and cranked the winch, and Dad and Wayne Bear got pinch bars under the end of the lathe and levered it forward a couple of inches at a time until we could pick up a roller on the edge of the apron. Get it up on rollers. Once we got it on rollers, it wasn't too hard to move.
Huh? In fact, when we finally got it inside the shop, where it was level, where the concrete floor was level, with those rollers under it, we could just push it.
Well, what kind of rollers did you use?
Pipe.
Pipe.
Not that big one, now. Tight.
Yeah.
Just take a length of pipe, you see, and slip it under the sled that you made.
Uh-huh. And you had three of them. And while it was resting on two, you put the third under the front.
Mm-hmm.
And then push it forward until it was on the two front ones. Then you take the rear one out and move it up front.
Yeah, well.
Mind over matter, that's what they said.
Well, Wayne is more than an electrician then. Well, if he's willing to lend a hand on any old job that comes along while he's
here. Most of these people up here are that way. Of course, he was supposed to be wiring that rotoburner all that time, but he saw we needed help, so he dropped what he was doing and came over and gave us a hand.
But we had doped it out. We had several conferences with Fred and Wayne and Bill Krebs and everybody about how we were supposed to move it once we got it off the truck, so we knew about that. And that was no real problem.
There was one real problem left, though, and that was after we got it over against the wall, you know, where John wanted it. How to get it off of those 4x4s and down on the concrete.
Yeah.
That was another good trick. We did that with hydraulic jacks.
Well, do you have hydraulic jacks, or did you borrow?
I have one in my truck that I bought from Claude. Another one of my Claude Sheets specials. Got it up so that we could get the beams loose from one end and pick up one end at a time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the beams loose and pulled aside from that end and that's still attached to the other end and on the floor. But then getting it down was the problem, because we had to prop the jack up off the floor to lift the lathe. It only lifts about 2 inches, you know. Those hydraulic jacks don't have a high lift. And so we propped it up and lifted the lathe. But then, even when you let the jack down, it still wasn't on the floor. So I had to go over to Fred and borrow another jack and put that under there and jack it up just enough to get the first jack out, and then let it down another 2 inches. And then put a jack in again and let it down another 2 inches. And swap jacks, you know, letting it down 2 inches at a time until it got to the floor. And then do the same thing with the other end. Boy, that was a thing.
Well, now, is Wayne as much of a as colorful a character as Fred, for instance?
Not in the same way.
He seems very quiet. When I'm over there, he won't say a word.
Well, he talks a lot, only most of the time he's talking to himself. You get over there. You get over there and you'll get hung up on some of his wiring or other, and he'll start talking. And he'll talk and talk and talk, only he's talking to either the wiring or talking to himself. But and he usually has a big wad of tobacco in his mouth, which probably was one of the reasons he wasn't talking much while you were there.
It gets a little thick. Of course, he go over to the stove every once in a while, open it up, and raise a cloud of steam.
Spitting into the stove.
Yeah.
But
he spits in it instead of on it.
Oh, he's very careful. He'll either go over to the stove or he'll go outside and spit. Of course, which runs up his time. I mean,
he doesn't figure his time anyway that way. You know? He says he figures his time on the basis of what he gets done rather than on how many hours he spends at it. So,
well, you know how Garvey figures his time. If he stops to talk to you, he looks at his watch and he subtracts whatever's talking time.
His talking time and his working time.
Yeah, right? And he won't let you pay him. I mean, absolutely, you cannot pay him for the time that he considers he didn't work. He's very strict.
Well, Wayne will fool you if you just, you know, in appearances. He's a smart man.
Yeah.
And he's been around. He took flying lessons at one time. I don't know whether he ever flew or not.
I guess he did.
Because he knew a lot of people who had private.
He was telling us airplane stories the other day about some guy that he flew with. Where was it?
Up in Indiana.
Indiana? Yeah. Or no, Ohio, around Dayton somewhere.
Yeah, around Dayton.
Was their base. And he flew with this guy that was evidently quite a crack pilot, later a cracked up pilot because he got killed in an air race. But this guy was learned his flying in the old
Seat of the Pants school.
Yeah, the Seat of the Pants school. He was flying at old Waco out of Dayton or thereabouts, some little town close by where they had a grass airstrip. And used to go fly passenger hops, you know, pick up charter passengers from and fly them around, or do express package runs and things. But he had all kinds of wild stories about that. And then he used to work in the mines up in West Virginia at one time.
Wayne did?
Yeah. I think he was a tool crib supervisor up there. And he used to work the night shift. He said he'd like to work the night shift because he'd have the days off. And he'd come in at night, and he would wear a big sheepskin coat when it was cold, you know. And he'd go down to the tool crib, and the workers, the guys who did the digging would come by to him, you see, and he'd sign them out their tools and their dynamite, whatever they were going to use. Then he'd go back in the corner and sleep because there wasn't anything to do during the night shift, and the guys would go down and do whatever they were going to do, and he would sleep, and if they came by and needed something, he'd give it to them and go back to sleep. So he said that was a pretty good job.
He was in the service, too, in the Pacific,
yeah,
in the Second World War.
Oh,
we were talking about Don's cannon, making cannons, and he's, and how much noise they make, you know, this 4th of July salute. And he said on his way over to the Pacific, he was on a troop carrier, and there wasn't much to do. And most of the men would, every chance they got, they would either be playing poker or shooting dice or sleeping. And he said a whole bunch of them one time got up under the forecastle, the front deck, not on the top deck, but just below it, of the ship. And they were snoozing away, sleeping. And all of a sudden, the deck gun, you know, they have one or two, about six,
five-inch
guns for anti-submarine use, decided to have some target practice, and it was mounted, you see, right above them at the prow of the ship. They let go with that thing, and he says there were men scattering all over that.
Well, I could just see that gun crew, you know. Somebody probably got out there and looked over the side and saw all these GIs sleeping on the deck down there. Uh-huh, we're going to have a joke. And you could see that gun crew just creeping up to the gun real quietly, opening that block, slipping that round in there, close it down. One for effect.
That reminds me of that story you were telling me about. Who was it that said he went to sleep in the cannon in the First World War?
Well, that's Papaw.
Was that
Papaw? That's Papaw story.
Fred's Bob.
Yeah. About how he, what brought it on was he saw me working on my wagon wheels up there at Fred's, and he said, oh, says you got you some wagon wheels. I said, what you going to do with them? And I said, well, I'm going to build a cannon. Got a barrel that I'm going to mount on these as soon as I shorten the axle tree and shape them up. He says, oh yes, says, I had an experience with a cannon once. He said, it was in the First World War. Says, I was in France in the trenches, and it was quiet one day, and I got to looking for a good place to sleep, and I couldn't find anything that looked dry. Except an old cannon barrel, so they had a 16-inch rifle sitting out there, and I crawled up inside and closed the door and went to sleep. That was pretty good. Said, but they come attacked about that time, and the old gun crew come out and they whopped in around and let fly. He says, carried me about 2 miles through the air before I started coming down. I come down and landed astride a haystack, went plumb through it. It broke my fall, and so I just landed on the ground on the other side, says, but it would probably kill me if I'd hit the stack pole.
Do you know Papaw well?
Not real well.
I've just met him that time when the other time when Fred was in the hospital, and I went up to help Betty in the store. And he came in, but he was very quiet that day. He just sat around for a while.
He doesn't have much to say most of the time.
Well, you have to have something. It's like Don says, you have to have something to talk to him about.
That's right.
I didn't have anything. I didn't know where to start. And it was my first time I'd met Betty, so I didn't. I mean, the whole family was strange. Were strangers to me, and I didn't know how to start anything.
Well, you know that copy lathe that Don finally got from Uncle Joe Dillon is not the one that Uncle Joe had set aside for him. It was in parts, and Uncle Joe was going to put it together and then sell it to Don.
The trouble was that Claude sold all the machinery out before Joe could get his work done.
Don bought all the machinery and moved it.
Devil, what you should have done was to have brought Uncle Joe out to the well, he didn't have the power, though.
No. But, Uncle Joe's in a bad way anyway, though, because he's getting old and ailing and doesn't feel too well most of the time and finds it difficult to get anything done. and he never did get anything done fast. But he decided, I guess, finally that he wasn't going to get much out of that copy lathe himself, but he didn't have time to fool with it, so he'd go ahead and sell it to me. But he sold me the sander to go with it. So I've got essentially everything I need there. But
well, didn't you say that Uncle Joe was an inventive sort of fellow? I mean,
you know, I don't know whether it's inventive or whether he just picks things up very quickly. I don't know of anything that I think of right off that he actually invented, but he could make a tool. If he had ever seen one like it before, he understood the principles and he could reproduce it. They tell me that he's been to Washington several times with patents to try to get patents, but I don't know if anything ever came of it. And I don't know whether they were really things that he developed himself or whether they were just things that he stumbled on and they seemed to be good ideas and other people had thought of them first or what. But this copy lathe that I have is not an invention of his. I mean, it was a standard tool. You know, that used to be an old smoking pipe factory to make briar pipe bowls.
Well, that was during the Second War when
they couldn't import the briar. And he worked there then. He's been there for 35 years, he told me. And he said in those days they had a bunch of those in that pipe factory with 9-inch saws on them. And he said that a man in those days was expected to, was expected to use one of these machines and turn out around 72 dozen pipe bowls a day. And said a lot of the guys made bonuses for doing overages, for exceeding the quota, because evidently they worked real well. But the idea stuck with him, and he made one for himself, made two actually. And this is one of them. And it'll handle anything from zero to about 25 or 26 inches long. He's made gun stocks on this and all kinds of handles for axes and hammer handles and things like that. He tells me that he made quite a bit of money making handles like that. But the way it works is that you put the pattern in there are two spindles that look rather like a wood lathe spindle. That is, you've got a pin at one end, a center, and at the other end you've got a little prong that has teeth that bite into the end of the wood. And there are two of these mounted on parallel bars, and they run on a slide so that you can slide them back and forth, and they slide together, and they're pivoted with bearings so that and a chain runs across to each of them so that when you turn a handle on one of them, the other one turns the corresponding amount. And it works just like the key copiers that you see in hardware stores, where you put a blank key in one side and the old key that you want to copy in the other side, and then there's a feeler that follows the grooves in the key. Well, this has a disc that follows the pattern that you put in, and then you put the blank stick of wood in the other side, and the saw runs along and cuts cuts the pattern into the blank.
Mm-hmm.
And it works very well.
Well, now, Don, you had that lathe. It can be used as a wood lathe, just not copying anything. I mean, you could use it, couldn't you?
No, because it doesn't spin.
Oh.
Really, the term lathe is misleading in terms. But what it does is the cutting is done by a saw. It runs horizontally along the piece of wood, and you cut one slice along and then you turn the piece of wood a little bit and make another pass with it, and then turn it another quarter of an inch or so and make another pass and cut that way all around the piece of wood. Whereas with a lathe, you're spinning, and you just run the tool in and it slices a circle.
Well, now, this monster lathe that you bought, that's a lathe that will work both on wood and metal. Is that the reason you had to have such a...
Well, I'm hoping it will. I'm at the moment a little unsure as to whether or not it's going to turn fast enough to do a good job on wood. I have to wait and see. I haven't been able to run it up to full speed yet because I don't have any belt dressing for it. But I don't know. Uncle Joe is a very very remarkable person in many respects, and in some ways a very sad person. I don't know. He and his whole family, evidently, all of the Dillards, have the reputation around here of being able to do anything when it comes to mechanical genius. But he never did anything with it, so to speak. Claude says he's always lived in... he lived in that old factory building down there. And he would just make himself up a pallet and lie on the floor.
Didn't have it?
No, never has been, as far as I know. He used to live over at, in the Parker Tie, one of the sheds at the Parker Tie place, and is sort of knocked around from pillar to post. Never has taken any interest in owning a home or building anything for himself. He just likes to tinker. Mm-hmm. And
how did he and Claude Sheets get?
Claude sort of bought him with the building, I guess. Claude bought the building and Joe went with it. Joe's lived in that old Tucker building so long now that he thinks he owns the place. It's been kind of a shattering experience to him to see it sold out from under him. I don't know what's going to become of it. He's got a sister over in the country somewhere, but I don't know whether they get along or what. He goes over to visit her every once in a while, but I don't know whether she would take him in permanently or not.
Can you give him a pallet in your shop so he can show you how to make those wheels?
I don't know. But he told me once how he got started in blacksmithing. He said that when he was about 13 or 14, the village blacksmith then was... the shop was fascinating to him, as it was to most boys at the time. Everybody would go around, hang around the blacksmith shop, because the blacksmith was the local genius who could do anything. And he said that the blacksmith then was a very taciturn sort of man who didn't talk much. In fact, he wouldn't even speak to you if he came in the shop. You had to... It was your dime, you had to start the conversation. And he said that for a long time he would just go in the shop and watch. And the guy would work at his forge or do whatever he was doing and wouldn't even pay any attention to him. And he said, and finally the guy did start to talk to him a little bit. And he would go in and they would talk about blacksmithing and about other topics of interest at the time. And he said that after about 3 or 4 years of this, the guy began to show him some things, and he would pick up little tricks of the blacksmithing, and finally they got to be pretty good friends, and they used to, Joe had an old car by that time, and they would get in it and drive to into Wilkes County or someplace and get a couple of beers. And so one night they went over there and sat around for a while and imbibed a little bit. And finally the old blacksmith said, "Well," said, "Joe, did you ever notice that I was a hard man to get acquainted with?" Joe said, "Yes, that I did." And the old blacksmith said, "Well, did you ever wonder why I was a hard man to get acquainted with?" Joe said, "Yes, that I did." And the old blacksmith said, "Well," he said, "it's like this," he said, "if you make friends too easy, you get too many friends that are just friends because you can do for them. And they'll just come around when you want something done." And he says, "Pretty soon you're doing all your work for friendship and you're not making anything at it." And he says, "I believe in choosing my friends very carefully."
Takes years.
It takes years, yes. Be sure that they're not just there to take advantage of you. But I think that must have made a lasting impression on Uncle Joe, because he's pretty much that way. And you ask anybody around and they'll tell you. You don't just walk up to Uncle Joe and say, "Well, I need something done, and you're a good old boy, you're going to do it for me, won't you?" It don't work that way.
Well, do you go in and talk with him a while about something else, or how do you get to him?
Well, if you have to do something and need a job done, and you want to go to Uncle Joe to get it done, you go in and you say, "Well, there's a formula, it's a ritual." You go in and you say, "Joe, Mr. Dillard, I've got a job here, and it's been hanging over me for a while. I said, I don't know how to do it, and nobody else in the county knows how to do it. They say you're the only one around that knows how to do this. I'd be much obliged to you if you could have a chance sometime, take a look at it and see what you think of it. Of course, there's no hurry, just whenever you get around to it." Of course, there can't be any hurry, because Joe doesn't work in a hurry. if you try to rush him, he'll just tell you where to go.
Well, actually, when he did that work for you, they cut that cut that oak for the trail, or whatever it was he cut.
Well, now Joe didn't do that, you see. Claude did that.
Claude did it. Well, I was thinking Fred was the one who spurred somebody, called him and asked when he was going to get these things done for him.
Yeah, that was Claude that did that for me. But. Joe just doesn't move fast. But when he does the job, he'll do it right.
Don had some visitors yesterday at his shop.
Yeah, I always get visitors when I'm
out
there.
Well, you're going to have to be like the old blacksmith now and go on about your work and let the visitors watch.
Well,
Yeah, well,
yes, you'll never get anything.
we weren't even there when these showed up. Some of them were who?
Some guys from Industrial Plastics where I work came out to look at it.
Oh, really?
Some of the machinists and people there had heard about what I was doing. I expect they were disappointed, though, because probably they wanted to see a cannon. And of course, I don't have any guns over there yet.
Yeah, well, you know, Fielding Roden came by here one day, and he wanted to know what you were doing, and I tried to explain it to him, and he said, "I sure would like to see one of those cannons." And I was going around here on the porch. I said, "I can show you a couple of these. He's got lined up," and I showed him the one on the porch and then let him look at the one underneath the porch, the one that's mounted.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "That's a beautiful thing. Somebody ought to want something like that." He says, "Somebody ought to want it."
He's not sure who.
He doesn't know who. Somebody. Well,
that's the standard response that I get from a lot of people, you know. Well, who in the world would buy a thing like that? But there are people.
What?
Who in the world needs a cannon? Who wants a cannon? But a lot of people do, evidently.
If people, you take this wily fellow down here on 16 who's got all those model, what is it, model A's or model T's, lined up along his fence line.
Yeah.
What? He's not dumb. He doesn't have them lined up along the fence line just for fun.
No.
And the tourists come through here and they say, "Here's a dumb farmer who doesn't know what these model T's are worth. I'll go in and I'll get myself a bargain." And they go in and buy parts from these old junk models up there. But with people willing to put the work into rebuilding old cars and old airplanes, it stands to reason that there are
somebody would rebuild an old cannon.
As many kooks or what cannons as there are.
This is the end of Channel 1 Side 2. This is the end of Channel 1 Side 2. This is December the 7th, 1969, Sunday morning, around the breakfast table in the midst of a sleet storm.
Now,